It was pouring rain, sheets of rain, on the night that Hong Kong returned to Chinese control. It was June 30th, 1997, and I was there, out on the streets, getting soaked. And then, inside a vast convention center, seeing a somber Prince Charles watch as Britain's flag was lowered down one flagpole and a Chinese flag rose on another. By that point, Hong Kong had been gone from China's control for a while, since 1842, when the Chinese emperor ceded Hong Kong Island to Britain, which had just won the first opium war with China. For good measure, the Chinese also leased the British land physically attached to mainland China, Kowloon, the new territories, plus more than 230 outlying islands. Hong Kong wasn't much then, about 7,500 people, but with its harbor and access to the Chinese coast and other parts of the region, its potential was clear. Up rose a financial and trading center, and eventually a world-class business hub. But China wasn't done with Hong Kong. When the lease for Kowloon and the new territories and all those islands came up, China's then leader, Deng Xiaoping, said, "Actually, we'd like those back." And while technically Britain didn't have to give up Hong Kong Island itself, it wasn't like it was going to be able to function on its own if China's leaders didn't want it to. And they didn't. From their perspective, the return of Hong Kong to the motherland was a matter of national pride, a way of righting what many Chinese saw as more than a century of humiliation at the hands of foreign powers. That's the phrase that's used in Chinese schools, in the state-run media. In fact, that phrase preceded the Communist Party. In the run-up to the Hong Kong handover, when I was living in Beijing, there was a countdown clock in Tiananmen Square. For 2.5 years, it counted the days, hours, minutes, and seconds until Hong Kong returned to Chinese control, until China could start telling a new kind of story about itself, about its national pride and power and place in the world, a story much more in keeping with how Chinese had seen themselves over the centuries than with the beaten-down and cowed version of China that many said had come out of the First Opium War and had never really recovered.
There's a strange mixture that's very common in China, which consists of simultaneous feelings of superiority and victimhood.
This is Howard French.
I teach at the Graduate School of Journalism at Columbia University. I'm a former correspondent of the New York Times for many years, and I write about China and about Africa, sometimes together and sometimes separately.
One of the places Howard was a correspondent was in Shanghai, in China. He started studying Chinese when he was still based as a correspondent for the New York Times in Japan. He had a Chinese tutor.
And I met with her several times a week. She came to my house and we would have an hour or two of lessons. I don't know, maybe 4 or 5 sessions in, she said to me at the end of the day, "Mr. French, you seem like a really nice guy. I just thought I should give you some personal advice since you're going to China soon." And I didn't know where this was heading. And so I smiled and said, "Great." And she said, "Please don't take offense, but what I want to tell you is that Chinese people are smarter than everybody else." And I sort of sat up in my chair in a kind of moment of slightly stunned or startled. And
was she being ironic?
No, she was not being ironic. I mean, she was being friendly. There was a smile on her face. She thought she was being...
helpful?
Helpful, yeah. I should just be prepared for this.
Now, I've got to say, in 14 years living and reporting in China, I never had a conversation like that. But I have seen rising Chinese nationalism and its accompanying sense of wounded dignity when anything stops or slows what many, but not all, Chinese see as China's much-deserved and overdue rise to reassume the central place China held in the world for centuries. In fact, the very name for China in Chinese is Zhongguo, Middle Kingdom. That's middle as in central, predominant, most important. You're a Zhongguo Ren, a Middle Kingdom person. No matter where you are in the world, while everyone else, even in their home country, is a Waiguo Ren, an outside the kingdom person. So what does this view of China's place in the world from its ancient past have to do with the role China might play in the future? Possible answers coming up. This is Whose Century Is It?, a podcast about ideas, trends, and twists shaping the 21st century. I'm Mary Kay Magstead. So, the past doesn't necessarily foretell the future, but it often shapes it. China is interesting in that over the past century, Chinese have at various times tried breaking with the past. The rise of the Communist Party and the Cultural Revolution were all about that, as were earlier movements, and enthusiastic adoption of Western ideas and practices that many Chinese at the time considered more modern and just better. But also, especially over the past decade or so, there's been a re-embrace of the past, of Confucianism, which was actually ridiculed by Mao Zedong as old and inappropriate for the new China. There have been clubs where Chinese dress up in Han Dynasty costumes and study China's ancient history and appreciate all that made China a mighty empire over the centuries. And there's Xi Jinping, China's current president and top party leader, who himself has been harking back to an idealized past, both the early years of Communist Party rule and the ancient traditions of Chinese culture. He's been encouraging Chinese to embrace the idea, an ethnically based idea, that the Chinese race is destined for glory and for global dominance. And perhaps it is, but there are a lot of variables at play. Personally, I'm betting a billion plus Indians and about that many Africans have their own ideas about whose century this might be. But as to where China's leaders have gotten their ideas about what China is and should be in the world, Howard French's most recent book is called Everything Under the Heavens: How the Past Helped Shape China's Push for Global Power. We sat down to chat about the ideas in his book at the Columbia University School of Journalism in New York. I started by asking about a story Howard tells in his book about how his interest in China began with stories he heard as a boy from his father.
This was when I was a small boy in Washington, D.C. in the early 1960s. And the stories that came down to me via my father were of stories that his father had told him of his fascination, I suppose, in the 1930s and 40s with China as a place, literally, as the cliche has it, on the other side of the world, where there was this civilization that consisted of people who thought that they were superior to everyone else. And the reason that this would be particularly fascinating to people like us, an African-American family in Washington, D.C. in the early 60s, is that Washington was still a rather segregated city, and the United States was just then emerging from a very widespread state of segregation. Segregation, of course, is based on ideas of racial superiority, and to know that there was another civilization that was not the same one that thought of itself as being superior in this country, thought of itself as being superior to everyone else. And so this was the germ of an idea that kind of, well, it captivated my father first and later captivated me.
I would say for me as a correspondent in China, I was always sort of struck by two things going on at once, that at an individual level, people could be incredibly open-minded and curious, but when it came to particular issues, and especially sensitive issues at sensitive times, people would fall back on certain ways of looking at the world, looking at China's place in the world, looking at what the world was doing to China, and especially what the United States was doing to China. And there was kind of a set narrative. China should not be in the place it's in right now. You should not be treating us like this. China is more important than how you're seeing us.
I often had conversations with people where you feel slightly patronized, where they're telling you, in effect, that it's okay if you don't really understand China so well because China is so much more complicated and sophisticated by implication than the place you come from. I left the New York Times in 2008 to come teach journalism here at Columbia, and I've been back to China every year since then for substantial periods of time, at least a month or two, and often longer. But the first couple of years, I taught summer courses in a Chinese university in Shanghai, and I think it was that first summer doing this. I had a conversation with a Chinese person who asked me what it was that I was teaching in Shanghai, and I began to describe one element of what I was doing as history. And he said, "History? Oh, that's interesting. So what history is it?" And I said, "Well, it involves some Chinese history, and it involves some American history." And he said, "American history, that must be, like, really easy to dispose of." And I sort of let it wash past me. I didn't take offense at that. But that's a common sort of one aspect of what I think of as this kind of native superiority, particularly at the official level or at the sort of senior corporate level, where it's often said or implied that we foreigners, or as Chinese people often say, Lao Wai.
Which means old foreigner.
Old foreigner, old outsider.
It can be a little affectionate. It can be said that way.
It can be said sometimes affectionately, sometimes less affectionately. Yes. We should be forgiven because it's basically impossible for us to understand China in all of its depth, subtlety, and complexity.
So in your book, you say that you're setting out to sort of try to normalize China, to make it not be so exceptional, that you can look at China's aspirations in the world and not think that they stand apart from U.S. aspirations or the aspirations of any other great power. Why do you feel this is important, and why did you decide to frame the book the way you did in terms of reaching back quite far into China's ancient history to see where the roots of its sense of itself come from?
The reason that I try to de-exceptionalize China is because I think that a lot of China's present-day behavior can be understood in classical state power terms. A political scientist would probably resort to the term realist, that, you know, China as a leading power that has been growing at the pace that it's been growing for the past generation, plus maybe a little more, is taking on or is beginning to express ambitions that come with rapid rise in the world, and that you can look at this and see this at various other stages of history with lots of other examples, and that to that extent, China throwing its weight around in the South China Sea, or China trying to integrate Central Asia and beyond via big infrastructure and financial schemes, or China competing with the United States in more and more direct ways militarily in terms of the build-out of its armed forces, that all of these are very normal kind of great power behaviors. And therefore, to exoticize China and to see it as some kind of outlier or some kind of exception to the past, because China is, I think, to the broad public, still a relatively unfamiliar place, would be to misunderstand China.
It's worth pausing for a moment here to expand on a couple of those things. The big infrastructure and financial programs that China's promoting. One is the Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank. China created it in 2013 to make financing available for infrastructure projects in the Asia Pacific. It now has 56 member states with another 24 prospective members, including some in Europe. And it has $100 billion in capital, about half of what the World Bank has. And all of that looks mighty inviting at a time when the United States, under President Trump, is reducing international aid and investment. Another big project of China's has echoes of an era of ancient glory, the Age of the Silk Road, 1,500 years ago, when China had what the world wanted, silk, tea, and more, and traders would come from as far as Europe to get it. China's now trying to build a new Silk Road of sorts, two actually, one by land and one by sea. It's investing hundreds of billions of dollars to build out roads, railways, and other infrastructure in Asia, the Middle East, and Europe, pretty much where the old Silk Road was, though with some expansion into Eastern Africa. All of this has the rather unwieldy name of One Belt, One Road, and it benefits China in a number of ways. In the short term, all this infrastructure building will use Chinese steel and aluminum and more, for which there's now overcapacity within China, too much of it being manufactured, especially by state-owned enterprises, since China's own infrastructure building has slowed down. But a longer-term goal is to cement China's economic leadership in the region, to make it the hub of economic activity, the indispensable nation. That was driven home when Japan's Prime Minister Shinzo Abe said in May 2017 that Japan might be interested in participating in this One Belt, One Road thing as long as everyone can use all this new regional infrastructure. Chinese state-run media blasted him for trying to set conditions to serve Japan's own purposes and said, of course, this wouldn't be allowed. Now, that might not sound so neighborly, but one, China's leaders want to leave Japan in the dust as regional economic leader. And two, when you think about it, what rising power, including the United States, has held back when opportunity to expand influence presented itself? Some such rising powers did it through establishing colonies. Most European powers, the U.S. did too, by the way, in the Philippines and beyond. Some by making threats, like, you know, the United States again, the Monroe Doctrine, and going to war if such lines were crossed.
By those standards, Howard French argues, China, as a rising power, has actually behaved pretty responsibly thus far.
Because what I think what is happening with China does in fact conform with classical patterns, China's economic growth, if it fits classical patterns, will follow a rather predictable profile, that China has been in a phase for the last 35, 40 years of exceptionally fast growth by world standards. But it would be wrong to see this as unusual or unusually threatening, especially because countries that undertake the kinds of reforms that China has undertaken in this time frame and which reintegrate with the world market, as China has reintegrated after a period of long, mostly self-imposed isolation from the world market, tend to enjoy a rapid catch-up phase, after which various other things happen. The economy matures, and as the economy matures and the catch-up phase ends, growth tends to slow down, and you begin to then have to wrestle not with the problems of catch-up, which involve fast growth, but with the problems of middle age and beyond. I don't mean middle age demographically, although that's a huge challenge for China. I mean middle age economically. The other thing I'm trying to do in de-exceptionalizing China is to help the reader understand that the last 40 years should not become a baseline from which we project the future and become therefore threatened or insecure about China because it has revoked the rules of economics and will continue to grow at this pace forever.
But in terms of Chinese exceptionalism or lack thereof, certainly the government and the Communist Party do frame certain things as though China is an exception, like the China dream, the sacred mission. There's also the China's military dream, which has only been talked about to domestic audiences by and large. Let's talk about what those are, and specifically the military dream, Xi Jinping's definition of it.
So let's start with the historical dream, which predates the present-day military dream and also predates the Communist Party. As I write in my book, early in the nationalist period in China, meaning early in the 20th century, you had leaders like Sun Yat-sen and Chiang Kai-shek who were successively obsessed with the idea of catch-up. And catch-up involved a very particular notion, particular to China, of overcoming humiliation. And what overcoming humiliation meant in part was that China, in their view at that moment, was just emerging from a century or so of subjugation or mistreatment by outside powers, most recently by Japan, but prior to that, and in fact to some degree simultaneous to that, by Western powers, Europe and the United States. And that the only way of overcoming humiliation was for China to somehow manage to live up to the remembered glory of its past.
Okay, can I just interject, though, that it always struck me as kind of odd that China, which was not fully colonized, has this narrative in a way that India does not, Africa does not, other places that were colonies do not, Southeast Asia. And not only do they have this narrative and have had it going back to Sun Yat-sen, but it was made part of the national educational curriculum right after the Tiananmen crackdown. Why?
Well, you put your finger on part of the answer, that China was not fully colonized, and therefore China's control over China's self-image was not ever fully relinquished by the Chinese. And this enabled China to hold on to some sense of continuity with its past that other parts of the world that you drew comparisons with were not. It's important also to say that compared to India and compared to Africa, China, although the thing we're calling China is amorphous and tricky over time, because if one concedes China has several thousand years of history, only for a very small period of that time has it been called China. Most of the time it has been called by the name of whatever particular dynasty was in power at the moment. And the contours and dimensions of this imperial state varied widely over time. So the thing we're calling China grew and it shrunk depending on what was happening in the surrounding world and the fates and fortunes of the particular dynasty. That being said, because China was never completely colonized, there's a sense of psychological, of political, of intellectual and moral continuity that exists in the minds of the Chinese elite with the entire Chinese past, meaning all of the prior dynasties. There's a sense of identity that says we are the descendants of this imperial enterprise that has existed going back, you know, depending on who you refer to, 4 or 5,000 years. That doesn't exist really to any similar extent in any other part of the world. India is largely a construction of British imperialism. Africa never had large states at any point in its past, and the present-day states were almost entirely defined by outsiders through a process of colonialization and imperialism. So China has, I think, this is a source of great cohesion or cohesiveness, and one could even argue strength, has this long-term perspective on identity that is rare in the world.
And then going back to the framing of the China dream and the China military dream, mm-hmm. how is that playing out specifically in the military sphere?
So I talked about Sun Yat-sen and Chiang Kai-shek, and Chiang Kai-shek in his diary wrote in every day's entry at the top of the page, overcome national humiliation. That's the way he began every entry. Overcoming national humiliation meant, among other things, but perhaps centrally, restoring the perceived or imagined greatness and, along with greatness, inferred superiority of China vis-a-vis other cultures, other nations, other systems in the world. This has become a grand mission of China ever since China was invaded and partially subjugated by Britain, France, and other colonial powers in the 19th century. And in its most current iteration, under the Communist Party, there has been an obsession first with economic performance, somehow managing to outstrip or overcome or surpass the economic performance of the great powers of the world. In the 1950s, Mao Zedong very famously during the Great Leap Forward said that within 3 years, China should outperform Britain by certain classical economic measures like steel output and things like that. The time frame he expressed for the United States was that within 10 years, we should be able to overtake the United States in terms of these similar sorts of economic measures. In the very same breath, one finds, along with this obsession with becoming economically superior, restoring a sense of power in harder terms, becoming a first rank and ideally top rank military power, meaning overcoming, surpassing whoever the competitor of the day is. So in the 1950s, the Communist Party wins the Civil War in China in 1949, and Mao Zedong becomes the chairman of the newly communist state in China at the end of that war. And right away, there's an obsession, literally right away, with acquiring nuclear weapons. I don't think this is perverse, by the way. The United States had deployed nuclear weapons in many parts of the immediate region. Very soon after the communists took over in China, the United States toyed with the idea of the use of nuclear weapons in various places, such as North Korea and Taiwan, to protect Taiwan, etc. Nonetheless, China became very obsessed with obtaining nuclear weapons. And the purpose of attaining nuclear weapons, a purpose in addition to defending against the United States or deterrence of the United States, was this idea of becoming a top-rank power. And this obsession became so overriding that it drove the dissolution of the alliance between the Soviets and the Chinese, because Chinese nuclear technology was coming from the Soviet Union. China didn't have a sector of nuclear scientists and of technology sufficient to produce a nuclear weapon. And so initially, China was very dependent on Soviet cooperation in that regard. And it was so eager to do these things that the Soviets became uncomfortable that a couple of really awful things could happen. One, they might start a war, the Chinese might start a war with the Americans. Or two, if they get the bomb, as it was called back then, they might get it into their heads that they're superior to us, the Soviets. Anyway, to fast forward to the present day obsession, the thing that is analogous to the 1950s and 60s obsession with nuclear weaponry, is the acquisition and development of what is called in a sort of jargon a blue water navy, that in order to become a first rank power and ideally a top rank power, meaning the most, at some point down the road, potentially the most powerful country in the world, you have to have a navy that sails the seven seas and that can stand its own against anybody else. And this begins with the idea, which is very much a present day obsession and not something projected down the road, of keeping any potential competitor, and most especially the United States, at bay in the near seas of the Western Pacific, meaning what the Chinese refer to as the first island chain, meaning west of the Philippines, west of Japan, west of Taiwan, west of Indonesia and Malaysia and all of that.
A decade ago, when I was based in Beijing, I did a series on how traditional U.S. allies in the region, and particularly in Southeast Asia, but also Korea, Japan, were looking at China's rise. And at that time, China was saying, you know, we're going to have a peaceful rise, it will lift all boats, everyone will be prosperous, come and enjoy the bounty of our economic rise. And at the time, a lot of China's neighbors were buying it, not Japan, but pretty much everyone else. Not so much now. China's become increasingly aggressive in the South China Sea, as seen by neighboring countries, Vietnam, the Philippines, certainly Japan, South Korea to some extent. Even North Korea, when I visited there in 2005, they were annoyed, very annoyed, that a Chinese think tank had come out with a paper saying that a part of North Korea, where the Goguryeo Kingdom was founded, was actually, you know, part of China. Mm-hmm. A North Korean minder was complaining to me about this. So as China starts to become more active in claiming what it believes is rightfully its islands, its fishing rights, its rights to control the seas, how do you see that playing out in the region? I mean, is there a way for this to happen without significant pushback beyond what's already happened?
That's really the $64,000 question, and it's kind of the core of my book, really. I think that we are entering right now a moment of very serious danger, which in my view is likely to last for the next 10, 15, at the longest 20 years, after which I think if we can get through this transitional period, tensions around this topic will subside. But we're entering the danger period because China has advanced so quickly, so far so quickly, and its strength, both economically speaking, in terms of industrial competitiveness, in terms of military capability, particularly in terms of capacities for self-defense and projection of force in the nearby seas, have come to draw close to the capacities of the United States. And so in a situation where you have a rising power and a status quo power in history, where the gap between the two narrows rapidly and dramatically, that is the precise situation of highest danger, because neither side is absolutely certain that it is able to prevail in a moment of instability or of conflict. And in the rising power, you have strong constituencies that are tied up in the investment and effort to acquire capabilities, which say, what's the point of acquiring all of these capabilities if you don't use them? And which have the capacity, these constituencies, to kind of put the leadership on the defensive and saying they're pussyfooting and they're being weak and they're not defending the nation and they're not helping overcome national humiliation, this sacred mission that has existed for so long, because we've got all of these fancy toys to play with and they're not letting us use them, right? And meanwhile, in the status quo power, what was once a very clear and unambiguous lead in all of these key areas, from economic strength and competitiveness to high tech to military capacity, et cetera, as you see the gap narrow, anxiety begins to increase, uncertainty begins to creep in, and you have a corresponding constituency which says, in effect, if we don't do something now to nip this threat in the bud, then it's going to be too late, that we have to assert ourselves now to make clear who's in charge or to make clear what the rules are, and that any leader who is not doing that is essentially giving away the farm, right? And so as the gap between the rising power and the status quo power narrows, you have these two parallel processes that are taking place in one side and in the other that make for a dangerous situation. What's happening in the surrounding region is that, again, one, I think, most usefully must resort to the realism that political scientists speak of. The neighboring powers are kind of watching kind of anxiously to understand which way the wind blows. And they would like, typically, most of them, in a classic situation, to hedge. And hedging means that, in effect, a situation in which the strongest power is a faraway power, what's called an offshore power, is a good one, because a faraway offshore power is not likely to do anything in a direct or kind of obvious way to kind of invade you or take you over or to sort of swamp you somehow in terms of immigration or to be totally overbearing in terms of the way it deals with you in terms of demands. And therefore, having the United States as an offshore power, its territory situated thousands of miles across the Pacific, to help us hedge against this neighboring power, which may use nice language like win-win and all boats are rising and let's get rich together, but is nonetheless right on our borders or nearly right on our borders, and whose people constitute large minorities in many of our countries, and which has a sense of rules of the road which doesn't conform with the sense of rules of the road that we have grown accustomed to for the last so many years, I mean, in the post-World War II era, that's uncomfortable to them. And so how do they respond to this? Well, the first thing they want to do is to avoid having to explicitly choose sides. And that means that most of them will want to obtain the benefits of economic cooperation with China, because China has been growing so fast and represents a huge market that's right on their doorstep, and to simultaneously enjoy the benefits of security arrangements with the United States, because the United States is this offshore power far away that has been the trustee and guardian of the established rules of the road and who doesn't seem threatening in many of the ways I just described. The other thing that they tend to do is they tend to seek ways to not just sustain a security relationship with the United States, but to hedge by increasing their cooperation with each other, meaning these smaller nations that exist on the periphery of China. And so you see lots of countries. Vietnam is the most interesting example of this, seeking to increase, you know, Indians are training Vietnamese submarine crews how to run submarines that are used, among other ways, to deter Chinese attacks, right? Japanese are helping pay for a new Filipino Coast Guard and a Vietnamese Coast Guard as well, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Australia plays in this game. All of the smaller countries, Malaysia, Indonesia, Philippines, Vietnam, Thailand, et cetera, are seeking ways to balance against China, soft balancing against China in ways that are not meant to be in your face or offensive to China, but allow them to hedge their bets. One final thing. In these sorts of situations, some number of countries, typically a very small number of countries, one or two or three countries in a complicated geopolitical setting like Southeast Asia or East Asia, will say, okay, so everybody else is hedging. We're going to bandwagon with China. We're just going to jump in with both feet and say we're China's friend. Where we have seen this most recently is with countries like Cambodia and, one could argue, Laos, which are saying, we're on China's doorstep, but China's willing to complicate the situation in Vietnam and to frustrate the United States. China's willing to give us so much money. We don't need guarantees from the United States, or we don't need to hedge with Japan and India and Vietnam and others against China. We're just going to fall right into China's embrace and let them make us flush with cash and with development projects.
Yeah. And of course, India looks with concern at China becoming closer allies or at least friends with countries like Cambodia and in the past Burma or Myanmar, but less so now, because it feels a naval threat potentially, since there can be ports, there are ports in both. You mentioned in your book, and I thought it was an important point, that if China doesn't observe rules and norms that, you know, show respect for the national interests of other countries in the region, it pretty much encourages those countries to seek assistance, to seek support, to seek backup from the United States, that it actually plays against China's interests. How much do you think China's leaders are aware of that?
There's a political scientist named Edward Luttwak, who I quote in the book at one point. He's basically a strategic thinker, and he's developed a theory which is not exclusive to China, but describes mentality or mindset that's common to very fast-rising powers as they begin to emerge and to more and more obviously contend with the status quo power. This mentality that he speaks of is called great power autism. And apologies to anyone who might take offense at this. This is not my term. But the point he's trying to make is that rising this far, this fast, is a giddy experience. And amid the giddiness that you experience during this rise, caution and all sorts of other perspectives are kind of lost. And so you are not likely to be terribly perceptive of the cost that you may incur by offending other people, meaning in this case, in your immediate neighbors, much smaller countries, because you think that when you rise as far and as fast as a country like China has risen, in some way it's an affirmation of your correctness. That takes precedence really over watching out for the feelings of, I'm using air quotes as I say the word that comes, of lesser peoples.
Okay, so China's economy is slowing down. As this happens, China's capabilities are going to start shifting. I mean, it continues to build up its military and modernize its military. But how much is there a risk that the government, which is very focused on making sure that the Communist Party stays in power, or that there's something where the Chinese government decides, okay, we've got a lot of thorny issues at home. It's time to do something outside of China to shift attention there, and maybe they don't calculate as carefully as would be in their best interests and those of others in the region.
Everything you said I endorse, but I would just sort of add the accent that you have invested in all of these shiny new toys, and the shiny new toys are implements of power. And if they're sitting on the shelf unused, the leadership becomes vulnerable to questions from nationalists, both in the general population and in sort of rival quarters of elite politics. Why is it that we are not being more assertive? And so this kind of creates a dynamic that can feed on itself and produce incidents that sort of spiral out of control. So this is all very possible. The next 10 years could be very messy by accident or by design to one degree or another. China could push in a way that involves hard power to make gains in the immediate region at the expense of the status quo powers, most importantly for this conversation, the United States and Japan, which are the most important status quo powers in the region. And there could be a war, or there could be at least some more limited form of conflict that could be ugly and very dangerous. That's one scenario that's very real, cannot be discounted, which we must be very attentive to, and that our diplomats have to figure out a way to prevent. I paint what I see as a rather more likely, or certainly a more hopeful kind of outcome. So the threat is based on not just this constituency of nationalists that I've described, but of a sense among the Chinese leadership that time is of the essence, and that, you know, the moment of opportunity is now, because China will not continue to grow at 6%. If one concedes this view, then you can imagine a leadership that says, look, in 10, 15 years, we could be down to 2, 3% economic growth per year, which is what happens to mature economies. This is the moment we have to make our big push. We have to lock in whatever gains we can lock in right now, meaning in the next 10 years. This is, for me, even before we get to the nationalism stuff, the sort of factor that should induce the most sense of worry about this transitional period. I'm hopeful that we'll muddle through, in part because I have to imagine that there are elements within the Chinese political elite who understand the cost of war and who have a sense of caution in them, despite the fact that the gap is narrowing between the United States and China, and even a sense that should China somehow narrowly, I don't think this is likely, but narrowly in the next 10 years come somehow to surpass the United States in military capacity, the gap would still be very small. In situations where the gap between leader and rival are very small, you don't tend to get very clear winners. And so this makes for a very messy, ugly, protracted, dangerous, horrible kind of outcome. And so I suspect you have elements in the Chinese political leadership who would say, look, we have to resist the people who are pointing to the shiny toys, because that way leads disaster. The gains we need to lock in are the gains we have achieved for our people over the last 40, by that time, 50 years. You know, we've risen from being a country of almost universal poverty to a country with a very large middle class. We have built systems of transportation and of housing and various other things that are world class or very nearly world class in many, many different areas. And we'll lose all of that if we reach for the shiny toys. Therefore, opportunity lies in stability. Once we're past this transitional period of 10, maybe 15 years, then other things begin to happen. The demographics of China, I think, kick in very, very powerful ways, where you eventually have hundreds of millions of people, literally hundreds of millions of people, who are over the age of 65. What happens to people over the age of 65? They have chronic illnesses, Alzheimer's, diabetes, heart disease, one thing after another that incur immense costs in terms of medication, in terms of supervised medical care, in terms of sometimes residential medical care. And China doesn't really have any of that yet. It hasn't built out those things because that's not the phase of economic life that it has been wrapped up in for the last generation. So if we get past this transitional period of 10 or 15 years, I'm very hopeful that China will say, listen, the status quo isn't as bad as we thought it was. We don't need to be such a grudging, kind of victim-centric country. We've done well. We've come a long way.
We're living the China dream.
This is a version of a China dream that maybe we didn't imagine 20 years ago, but it's a pretty good dream, and we should be very careful to protect it and not to do anything that would endanger it. And first and foremost, of course, that means conflict.
So one last question then, and that is what the United States should do in this somewhat tricky period to try to minimize the risk of conflict. And so in your book, you quote Shi Yinhong, who is a much-quoted foreign policy analyst. I've talked to him several times myself in Beijing. You mention a conversation you had with him where he said, the West shouldn't think so much about integrating China into the Western liberal order, but rather try to accommodate China. And that might have made sense, or it might have made sense from a Chinese perspective in thinking, well, you know, this is now our time. In 2008, 2009, during the financial crisis, 2010, there was a certain tone of triumphalism and like, well, clearly, you know, the U.S. is about to be in the dustbin of history and we'll just help you along. There's not much precedent for a great power to just sort of hand over power to the next power. So what's in it for the United States to do that, assuming anything is? And if not that, then what?
So I don't think there's any prospect of the United States handing over power by any kind of deliberative process. We're very far from any such imaginable scenario. I think that what Shi Yinhong had in mind was, in the context of that conversation, primarily a matter of security, that the United States should cede space to China in the Western Pacific, that the United States should say, in the long run, short of catastrophic war, which the United States, by the time this should, if it should happen, would not be certain of winning, there's no way that the United States can stop us from becoming the dominant power in the Western Pacific. And therefore, the United States should simply come to terms with that and kind of make way for us in the Western Pacific. The answer to your question that I would give is that there are many things that the United States can concede to China, not the Western Pacific, not military strength, not competition over hard power terms, but things that involve cooperation and involve the interests of third parties in terms of their economic development, that involve regional integration. The United States, I think, has been very wrong-headed in terms of the politics of integrating China into the architecture of the global economy.
How so?
The United States has been very slow and, one could say, grudging in terms of allowing China a greater voice in institutions like the World Bank and the IMF. For an economy of China's size, I think there's a very clear argument that China deserves a much bigger voice in institutions like that, which are called the Bretton Woods institutions and which have typically been in the American back pocket, so to speak. This is a very low-cost way of making China feel like it has more of a stake in the workings of the international system that we largely designed. So China saw that there was not much willingness to make way for it in a peaceful sort of financial set of institutions like these. China said, well, so, okay, well, we'll go out and we'll make some new institutions of our own. And they announced the creation a couple of years ago of the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank. And in relation to that, also something called One Belt, One Road, which is a very ambitious, vast regional infrastructure creation network that will try to integrate China and Central Asia and Europe even eventually and other parts of the world via the creation of rail networks and ports and airports and various other things. The United States' initial response to that was negative, discouraging friends and allies from joining in and not really saying very nice things about it and questioning whether this represented a challenge by China to the global system such as we recognize it. Well, so if you don't allow China readily and with smiles and goodwill into the existing architecture, and you don't want a war, which is the other alternative, then why would you not want China to create peaceful architecture of its own that could exist alongside the existing architecture? The Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank was open not just to European countries, but the United States was invited from the beginning. So you say, yeah, so maybe we have some questions about the rules. Can we have a conversation about that? Once we settle those terms, we'd be happy to join. In fact, could we be charter members? That'd be great. We'd like to encourage you. That would have been the way to go.
Although the whole U.S.-Asia pivot was partly inspired or encouraged by, I think, a perception that these sorts of efforts by China was a long-term strategy to try to push the U.S. aside in the region, to woo traditional U.S. allies and others and make the U.S. sort of superfluous in the region.
Right. But so what is a country to do when it begins to have economic surplus? I mean, you have a choice. You can close your economy off and become totally inwardly looking, which other countries would denounce as mercantilism. Or you can say, we're going to use these surpluses to inject finance in other parts of the world through a known and defined architecture, which is what AIIB is. The choice for me is a no-brainer as to which is better. You know, the United States, so this gets back to a very early part of our conversation when I said that the status quo power becomes very anxious about all sorts of things. You've got to make your choices, right? So what is our choice? Do we prefer that they compete with us militarily only? Or do we have enough self-confidence and belief in the worth of rules-based institutions to say, yeah, so the world's big enough for them to create some institutions too. They're not closed off to us. We can have a conversation with them about how the bylaws should be written. That's, relatively speaking, a good outcome.
So your previous book was China's Second Continent. It was about China's investment in aid and other activities in Africa. And at the time that China began investing heavily in Africa, there was also U.S. anxiety, you know, basically just trying to extract from Africa, and you're trying to influence African countries to do things the way you want to do them. But in fact, you know, even just a decade on, 10, 15 years on, there's a lot more infrastructure in Africa. African economies have gotten a bit of a boost from this. Feelings within Africa and in different places are mixed about, you know, how people feel about Chinese companies coming in, the way that China's investing. But net, there are opportunities now that didn't exist before. And in fact, it's sort of drawn other countries, including the United States, into paying more attention to African economies. Do you see that as, you know, maybe a way that China can be more constructive in its own region? Or that there's just too much at stake in terms of China saying, well, we have historically been the Middle Kingdom, the South China Sea is ours, Vietnam, you were part of us for 1,000 years, and we don't care if you thought you were just a colony, we thought you were part of China. In fact, if we want to think about it, Korea and Japan were kind of part of China too, and if we want to set things to rights, maybe eventually you all will be again.
You've read my book.
And I lived there for 15 years. Is there a way for China to play a peaceful role in the region that isn't going to freak its neighbors out?
So China went to Africa beginning in the early to mid-1990s, precisely because it was aware of the potential to freak people out. I'm writing another book right now, and the research for this book has led me to reread what the conversation in the United States was about Africa in the 1990s. So in 1994, you had an article in The Atlantic by a guy named Robert Kaplan called The Coming Anarchy. And in The Coming Anarchy, Kaplan presents this absolutely nightmarish vision of Africa, that it's a place out of which nothing good comes. It's this sort of ultra-Dickensian world of kind of horror.
So memories were fresh of anarchy in Somalia and genocide in Rwanda.
Right. But he extrapolated this to a degree that I consider irresponsible. And the Clinton administration, which was 1 year old at the time, circulated this document widely in the national security world of the United States.
Huh.
And this became a kind of, Robert Kaplan became kind of, for a time, the truth, the received truth about Africa and its place in the world for the United States. This was the precise moment when China was putting its initiative to enter the African world into gear. Nobody was paying attention to it. The United States was saying, Africa is horror, flee, run for cover, it must be contained, build a high wall around the entire place. Otherwise, horrible things like Ebola and AIDS and whatnot will come and infect the whole world. And next thing you know, Africans will inundate us and all the rest. That was the precise moment that China began to embrace Africa. And I don't think that's a coincidence. I think that China began to embrace Africa then because China perceived that Africa was becoming a completely uncontended space, that the West, the traditional powers, meaning European colonizing nations, and the status quo superpower, the United States, at that point, the kind of unipower, had turned completely away from Africa. Therefore, China could cut its teeth in Africa in ways that would not threaten anyone else. It could make up ground in terms of its international competition. It could win new friends. It could learn all kinds of lessons that could later be used in places like Southeast Asia or in Central Asia. So Africa became a laboratory for China in the 1990s, and we didn't even notice. We were so sort of overtaken with this idea of Africa as a hopeless kind of void space. And as to the rest of your question, we don't have any choice. I mean, China has emerged. China has not entered into, at least in, yet in a fully fledged way, into its kind of mature economic phase. So China still, to some extent, continuing to emerge. And China is going to project its energies and its capital outwardly for some period of time. So we have to look for ways to constructively engage with that. The only alternative is to try to isolate China and or have a war with China. Can China deal with the Vietnamese and with the Koreans and the Japanese and the various other people on its immediate periphery in ways that are not humiliating to them and that accommodate some sense from them of their own self-interest in the matter? This is a big open question. You know, China in the distant past, during what we call in the West the tribute system, certainly was able to do that. But that was in an era when China was the preeminent and for the most part, or at least very often, uncontested great power of that region. China now exists embedded in a much bigger, broader architecture of power built by the West and especially by the United States, that it's recognized by all of these other countries on its periphery. And it doesn't have the luxury of completely sort of wiping the slate clean and restoring kind of the old rules of the past. Some of the instincts of the past still exist among Chinese people and especially in the Chinese leadership, but they don't have the luxury of simply saying to the Vietnamese or to the Malaysians or the Singaporeans or the Japanese or Koreans, look, we're in charge now, it's the tribute system, come kowtow and do as we say and we will bestow upon you our good graces and allow you to trade a bit. That's the way the tribute system sort of worked, right, to be really crude about it. That's not going to happen again. The question is, how much room do the current rules have to accommodate some sense of Chinese sensibilities about the way things should be, and how much protection can there be in this flux for the interests and sensibilities of the much smaller nations on China's periphery? That's going to be a constant struggle. And what the outcome's going to be when we get past this transitional period is still uncertain. But I'm hopeful that as demography and some economic slowdown and some of the other things I talk about kick in, that China will get past what Luttwak calls the autistic phase, that China will get past the autistic phase and become rather more sophisticated about forms of engagement.
Howard French, thanks for joining me on Whose Century Is It?
Thank you, Mary Kay.
So the next decade or two may be a rocky ride, or not. China's thus far shown little interest in going to war with the United States, but smaller skirmishes, like those that have already happened in the South China Sea, may well continue or even intensify. But as Howard said, China's leaders do seem to feel a sense of urgency, that now is the moment to establish and cement a new leadership role for China in the world, before China's economic growth slows even more, before China's population ages too much, before the thorny contradictions and tensions of a communist party running a largely capitalist state make themselves even more apparent. And that's not even going into what will happen as new players rise on the global stage. More on that in coming episodes. Meanwhile, thanks again to Howard French, author of Everything Under the Heavens, How the Past Helped Shape China's Path to Global Power. You'll find a print version of this episode, with photos and links, on our webpage, pri.org/century. We're also on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and pretty much wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe if you haven't already. And if you like the podcast, rate us and leave a review. It helps others find it. I tweet at Mary Kay Magstad, that's MaryKayMagistad, all one word. You can send me a short message there, or if you'd like to send a longer note, email me at whocentury@gmail.com. Whose Century Is It? Is a co-production between me and PRI's The World in cooperation with the BBC World Service and WGBH. It's funded by a grant from the Henry Luce Foundation. Back soon with another episode. Thanks for listening.